The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Welcome to the Christian Outlook, the weekly radio program that sorts through the issues in our fast-changing world in a way that honors your Christian faith. Brought to you in partnership with our sponsor, the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy. A deeper look at one of the classic works of C.S. Lewis.
First of all, I would claim that if you want to know C.S. Lewis, you must know this book.
From a writer who has been shaped by Lewis and by this particular book for decades.
I don't read fluently Italian. But I read more than one translation of Dante, and the glory of the end matches the glory of Dante's achievement in the Paradiso at the end. That's how wonderful this is.
We'll get a deep look at what Lewis himself described as the favorite of his books.
I really do think this is one of the great modern epics in English.
A special edition of our program. I guarantee you, you'll enjoy this. I'm Don Crow, coming to you from my home station of WAVA in Washington, D.C. Thanks for joining us. C.S. Lewis is one of the most beloved of Christian writers. During his lifetime, he's widely reported to have said that he thought he would be forgotten after he died. He died on November 22, 1963, a day that is marked in infamy because it was also the day President John F. Kennedy was assassinated. And Lewis' death was, in fact, lost behind that of JFK. But Lewis' works have stood the test of time. Arguably, they have aged well and have gotten better over time. Many of you are familiar with the Narnia series and the films that made it to the big screen in recent years. Others were won to the faith by mere Christianity, and the Screwtape Letters have stayed alive with their onstage depiction through the excellent work of Max MacLean. But there are relatively few people who point to the book Perelandra as the pinnacle achievement of Lewis. Our guest today is out to fix that. He's James Como, one of the founding members of the New York C.S. Lewis Society, dating back to 1969. He's the author of Mystical Perelandra, my lifelong reading of C.S. Lewis and his favorite book. He was a guest of my colleague, Eric Metaxas.
You've written many books about C.S. Lewis. You are professor emeritus of rhetoric and public communication at York College. And I'm trying to remember when you were last here a few years ago, we talked about T.S. Eliot going on a double date, if you want to call it that, with, was it Vivian at the time?
It should have been.
Thomas Stearns Eliot, T.S. Eliot, and his wife Vivian went to dinner with C.S. Lewis and Joy.
Yes, indeed. David,
it's something like we made up.
Yeah, I know.
Right?
I know.
But I have a weird thing to tell you.
Go ahead.
The day you and I were together, it's got to be 4 years ago, I was going to the airport that evening to fly across the pond.
Yeah.
And at the airport at JFK, I bumped into somebody I hadn't seen in a long, long time. And we got to talking. And that subject came up of Eliot's having written the updated
prayer book.
And it was one of those moments, you know, if I believed in kismet, I just thought, my head's going to explode. I was just talking about this a few hours ago with James Como in my radio studio. I'm not the kind of person that talks about this kind of stuff incessantly. I mean, it's nice when I get to do it, but it was so bizarre. Yeah. Anyway, we'll come back to that. But I want to say that you've written a book about one of my very, very, very favorite books. It's called Mystical Perelandra. So there are a lot of people listening. So describe what is Perelandra for my audience. Tell my audience.
All right. I'll begin with the subtitle. Mystical Perelandra, my lifelong reading of C.S. Lewis and his favorite book. Because Perelandra, he said more than once, was his favorite book.
What year did he write it?
1943.
42?
Came out in 43.
Amazing.
Out of the Silent Planet, the first of this trilogy, had preceded it in 39. And That Hideous Strength, which is really a standalone thing, in 45, I think, was the third book. I think of it as the Ransom trilogy,
right,
because of the hero Ransom appearing in all three.
So let's call it the Ransom trilogy. Yes. So the middle book, and you say it's it was Lewis's favorite book, and boy, he wrote a lot of books.
Yes, he did.
It's called Perelandra. So it's a novel.
Yes, a fantasy. He would have called it a romance, using the old medieval classical term for an adventure. Now, Perelandra, people who don't know the book should know, is Lewis's name for Venus, the planet Venus. And in this book, Elwin Ransom travels magically in a coffin-like object transported by Eldila, angelic creatures, to this unfallen paradise, which is Perelandra, populated by two people, the king and the queen, prelapsarian, before the fall.
I mean, look, this is a heavy idea, so I'm going to have to interrupt a lot because
please.
I want my audience to be tracking. This is amazing stuff, folks. So this is a novel. It is brilliant. It is brilliantly written. As a writer who values writing, who values literature, there are passages in the book Perelandra, particularly toward the end, that are some of the most glorious passages of prose ever written in English, bar none. But the plot is that Elwin Ransom goes to this planet. It's his version of Venus, Lewis's version of Venus. And he sort of confronts the Adam and the Eve of that planet before the fall, and then is used by God to help them
prevent the fall.
To prevent the fall. I mean, this is heavy.
Well, let me comment first on what you said about Lewis's writing, all right? Because I'm a contrarian by nature, and I go out on more than one limb.
Yeah.
The only reason we can call the end of this book prose is because it's printed as prose. It's some of the greatest poetry in the English language. And I'll go further than that. I don't read fluently Italian, but I've read more than one translation of Dante. And the glory of the end matches the glory of Dante's achievement in the Paradiso at the end. That's how wonderful this is. Now, a scientist travels to Perelandra, and he's given himself to the dark side. So he's inhabited by no less than
Okay, so this is the plot.
Right.
Oh, we're talking about a book written by C.S. Lewis called Perelandra, written in 1943. And the plot is that this bad guy, whose name
really
I forget.
Bad guy, really bad. Weston.
Weston. Yeah, he's wicked. He's evil. So does he go there first? I can't remember how this works.
No. Ransom is there.
He's right.
He's met the Green Lady, who is the first Eve
the
of the
Eve
planet.
Figure of Venus. Yeah.
And Weston arrives, welcomes a spirit into him, and then proceeds to tempt the lady to disobey Malaldil, who is God the Son, in effect, the creator of the universe, the creator of Perelandra included, who has forbidden her to be on the fixed land during the night.
Now, see, this is, I realize, like, we need 1,000 annotations just to explain this. One of the things that makes Perelandra just hands down brilliant is that Lewis invents the idea that on this planet there are floating islands.
Yes. The planet's basically one big sea with these islands.
Floating islands, but there is a fixed land.
With a huge mountain on it.
With a mountain on it. Okay, so there is a fixed land, so it's not floating, and then there's these floating islands. And instead of saying, as we get from the scripture where God says, don't eat of that tree, the prohibition on Perelandra is?
Do not spend the night
on
the fixed land.
On the fixed land. You have to sleep on the floor. That's all we're asking of you. The prohibition, so this is an unfallen planet. Weston, who is the villain, he's not there yet. Ransom, the good guy, who's named Ransom for some big reasons here, right? He arrives on the planet, and he is, in a sense, charged with helping prevent the fall on this planet. It didn't happen here. Here, the fall happened, yeah. So it was not prevented. But Lewis, I mean, even for C.S. Lewis to have this idea, it doesn't get much bigger than this.
No, it doesn't.
It's like you want something tough to pull off. How about that?
It doesn't. The thing is, when Ransom first gets there, he has no idea what he's doing there. And then when he realizes what's expected of him, he can't believe it because he's ill-suited to this. He's a middle-aged philologist. And now he has to prevent this cosmic catastrophe. And there's no one to help him. He needs a miracle. And then he hears the voice, you know, you're the miracle. You're here to do this. And my view of this, and I really do think this is one of the great modern epics in English. It will rival anything from Greek and Roman literature.
Look, you, I've said the same thing. It's not you think, it is.
Okay.
Right?
And that makes Ransom one of the great unacknowledged heroic figures in Western literature.
Yeah, you think like, you know, Aeneas is a big deal? Come on. I have often said that Perelandra ought to be taught alongside Paradise Lost in a survey course. It's as good as anything in Western literature. If you don't mind, let's talk about the book before Perelandra, because let's say somebody picks this book up. Ideally, C.S. Lewis in 1939 wrote Out of the Silent Planet, which is about Ransom's trip to Mars.
Right.
He goes to Mars, he comes back, whatever. A few years later, he goes on this trip to Venus. So that's the antecedent. That's
yes.
the framing
yes.
of Perelandra.
Well, in the previous book, he goes to Mars unwillingly, but he also meets Weston there. So this time, he knows that he has a mission because these angelic creatures have told him that he must do this. So he knows what's up because of the framing of Out of the Silent Planet. But the thing that matters about this is that he encounters Weston, who's ripping the bellies out of frogs. He offers Ransom one of the frogs to rip for himself. And Ransom looks into the eyes of pure evil and understands, so this is what hatred was made for.
He realized that that's what hatred, in the good sense of hatred,
right.
was made for. In other words, he was supposed to hate evil, and he is now confronted with evil in a form so pure that something rises up in Weston.
The appropriate response
response to evil is this hatred, which is... It's a big idea.
Very big idea. Well, he battles Weston, and one of the things I love about this book, they have a debate in front of the lady, because Weston wants the lady to disobey. Now, remember, Weston is inhabited by this evil spirit. He doesn't need to sleep, right? Ransom needs to sleep. He's losing the debate. Ransom is losing the debate. So I wonder if you remember what he does. He hauls off with a nice left hand, a straight left hand, and decks Weston. And they get into a physical struggle.
Right.
A physical struggle. And one of the interesting things about this, you know, Lewis, who was a master of rhetoric, who distrusted the art of rhetoric, right? But it was a master of it. Very often in his work, language is getting a character into trouble, and Lewis finally has the character act. You've read your Narnia. You remember the silver chair. They're in underworld. The witch is enchanting them with this spell. And what does Puddleglum do? Steps with his naked webbed foot on the fire to break the spell. Stop talking. It's time for action. And that's the heart of spiritual theology, the development of our spirits. You go through this strife, but you have to act. You have to act.
Coming up...
I really do think this is one of the great modern epics in English.
We continue our conversation with James Como and Mystical Perelandra when the Christian Outlook returns in a moment.
As the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy enters our 25th anniversary year, we've remained committed to a single truth of world history, that ideas have consequences. To understand these ideas and their impact on today's politics, and to test them quantitatively, requires the unique curriculum we offer on our Malibu, California campus. Apply now for fall classes at pepperdine.edu/SPP. That's pepperdine.edu/SPP.
Welcome back to The Christian Outlook. I'm Don Crow. Perelandra, the volume of C.S. Lewis that we're considering today, is the second volume of his space trilogy. Before it was Out of the Silent Planet, released in 1938. Perelandra came out in 1943. And after it, That Hideous Strength, released in 1945. At the time of the release of Perelandra, Lewis was 45, relatively early in his writing career. And yet, James Como believes Perelandra is Lewis at his best. It also provides a unique window into Lewis himself, the medievalist, and yes, the mystic. Let's return to the conversation of Eric Metaxas with James Como, author of Mystical Perelandra.
First of all, I would claim that if you want to know C.S. Lewis, you must know this book.
Yeah.
Because all of Lewis is in this book. His learning, his soul, his imagination, his story.
More than any of his other books, this book, if you wanted a distillation of Lewis, you get it in Perelandra. Yeah.
Absolutely. But you get something else, and something Lewis was reluctant to dwell upon. What emerges from this book, in my view very clearly, is that Lewis was a mystic.
You say that C.S. Lewis is a mystic.
Yes.
In the tradition of the great mystics. Let's name some mystics.
Walter Hilton, St. Teresa of Avila, St. John of the Cross, Hildegard of Bingen, Evelyn Underhill in the 20th century.
Okay, so there's other ways to describe these people, but these are people who have an experience with the other side. These are people who see or experience God in a way that is not merely rational. There's something mystical about it. And we know there's a tradition of this going back two millennia, and it's real. And somebody of the intellect of Lewis, I mean, you can't get a finer intellect than Clive Staples Lewis had. It's clear when you read him, and you point this out in your book, it's clear that he had these mystical experiences, but he was diffident in that English way. He was so diffident about it. He kind of almost pretended like, no, not really. I don't want to embarrass myself. I'm not going to bring it up. I'll just put it in my fiction in such a way that if you're very careful, you'll pick it up. Yeah.
And he didn't want to put himself in that company, you know, because they're higher on the ladder of perfection than he could ever achieve. But one thing I point out, when he roused from a coma, Walter Hooper, his last secretary, was there, and Lewis popped up in bed, and he looked in front of him with a gaze as though he was seeing something else. And he said, "Oh, I never imagined. And what I point out in the book is, you know, if I ever get to meet him elsewhere, I'm going to say, well, Mr. Lewis, you did, didn't you?
You did imagine, and you put it in your books, you big phony.
Yeah.
Now, let me ask you, I don't recall, I've read a lot about Lewis, certainly not nearly as much as you, but I don't recall that moment that you refer to. So this is his last...
Toward the end.
Right toward the end. So Walter Hooper at this point is living at the Kilns in Oxford. But I don't recall this, that there's a moment that Hooper is there with him.
Yeah, because Walter had recorded it previously in a journal, and I don't think it made a letter, but recent biographies have picked it up.
Okay.
And I want to cite a book that was very important to me by a man named David Downing, who, along with his wife, Crystal Downing, are the co-directors of the Wade Center at Wheaton College, which is the great repository of Lewis's papers. He wrote a book called Into the Region of Awe. C.S. Lewis.
Awe.
Yes. C.S. Lewis as a mystic. And when I read that, I just thought, well, my problem with David, who's a wonderful gentleman and scholar, you know, he didn't go far enough. These are elements of mysticism in C.S. Lewis. David, they're not just elements of mysticism in C.S. Lewis. This is Lewis the mystic. And David points out to us that the first Christian mystic was St. Paul, who was transported to the third sphere, you know. So that book was very influential. And there can be no doubt in my mind that Lewis expressed that mysticism in this book, Perelandra.
That's right.
But under a guise, you know, the diffidence, as you pointed out.
Well, I want to, before we go further on this subject, I want to talk about you a little bit. You talk a little bit in this book about your own journey with C.S. Lewis. You encounter him in the 1960s. I don't mean him, the person, but his writing. And in 1969, here in New York, you start the C.S. Lewis Society.
I and 13 others.
You and 13 others. Talk about that. I mean, what were you doing? Where did you grow up, and how did you find yourself into reading reading this sort of thing?
You'll recall that the book is dedicated to the New York C.S. Lewis Society and to all our members, both here and gone away. And I found Lewis in 65 thanks to an article in National Review by Jeffrey Hart called Christmas, the Celebration of Christ, where he talked about this man. I'd never heard of Lewis.
Well, we forget that Lewis died in 63, and I learned from Walter Hooper personally, because I interviewed him for Socrates in the City. We had a number of wonderful, wonderful conversations. And I didn't realize the depth of his role in bringing Lewis to new audiences after Lewis is. We can talk about that more, but you. So here you are in 1965, and you're reading National Review.
And
that's when you bumped into the idea. Now you're a very young man. Were you an undergraduate at that time?
Yes, I was. And I was taking a literary criticism course, and he commented on Lewis's literary criticism, which is what I read first.
Uh-huh.
I read the criticism first, and I couldn't believe it. But what struck me in Hart's article was that this man is at the pinnacle of his profession. He is the leading medievalist in English literature.
Yeah.
Undisputably that.
Correct. Right?
And a Christian apologist at the same time. Right there in the heart of academia. That's where I am. And I'm a believing Christian in the heart of an unbelieving, very hostile academia. This guy, I have to find out more about this guy, you know, which he struck me and has always struck me as a very, very brave man, which, of course, he was in World War I. You know, he saw combat in the trenches in World War I, but very brave. He takes on the hardest questions with the hardest audiences. Debate anybody, right? Rout the field. And yet is this most respected English professor. So this was just – I just went nuts.
What's the book that he wrote? It's abbreviated Oh Hell.
Well, that's
– Oxford –
That's
something
the series,
of English literature.
The Oxford History of
History.
English Literature.
Right, and he wrote one of the volumes.
He wrote the thickest volume on 16th century prose and poetry.
Which was his field.
Which was part of his Middle Ages and Renaissance.
And he loved Edmund Spenser.
He did.
What did he say about Spenser? He said something about Spenser. You quoted in here.
I've quoted everywhere. Shall I quote it again?
Yes, please.
Edmund Spenser had branches to heaven and roots to hell. And in between the two came all the multiplicity of human life. To read him is to grow in mental health.
Okay, that line, to read him is to grow in mental health. Lewis says that about Spenser, who most famously wrote The Faerie Queen. And you say it about Lewis.
Oh, okay.
And I agree. It's to grow in mental health. Yeah. But people don't normally think about that I could grow in mental health. But that's really God's plan for us, isn't it?
Mental and spiritual
health,
of course.
Coming up.
Let us recall the pinnacle of Ransom's vision at the end. He sees the king, and he looks upon the face of the king. He realizes that he's looking upon the face of Jesus.
More on Mystical Perilandra with Eric Metaxas and James Como when the Christian Outlook returns in a moment.
Hi, it's Mike Gallagher. I start every day by reading through the stories at Daybreak Insider. It's a look at today's most compelling stories and provides responses from key conservatives in media and politics. Over 250,000 people get Daybreak Insider by email daily, and it's available to you at no cost. Go to DaybreakInsider.com and simply plug in your email. That's DaybreakInsider.com. In 5 minutes, you will be the most informed person in the office. That's DaybreakInsider.com.
Welcome back to The Christian Outlook, brought to you in partnership with the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy. Learn more at publicpolicy.pepperdine.edu. I'm Don Crow. The three books of C.S. Lewis's space trilogy have long been categorized as science fiction. Our guest thinks that such a categorization is wrong, particularly when it comes to the book Perilandra. We'll let him explain. Here again, Eric Metaxas with James Como, author of Mystical Perilandra.
This book, Perilandra, it is... I mean, I think you mentioned that Lewis was one of the greatest medievalists ever to have lived. And he brings the medieval cosmology, which our friend Thomas Howard wrote about. He brings this to bear on this book. And so it has this kind of medieval flavor to it. I'll leave it at that.
It could have been written in the Middle Ages. And one of the reasons is there's no science in it. One of the reasons I don't like this called science fiction is that Ransom does not go to Perilandra on a rocket ship, as he had in the previous book. He's transported mystically by these angelic creatures. So there's literally no science in Perelandra, right? I do want to get to something, though. The end of the book, as you recall, is Ransom plunging. He's fighting the unmanned, and he struggles with the unmanned. They fall into the sea, and he wakes up in darkness, and he realizes he's in a cave, and he has to struggle up the cave, a long, arduous climb. He's chased by who knows what behind
okay, look,
him.
This is, folks, I just got to tell you, this is, you have to read Perelandra, really, but what you skipped over here is that this evil figure named Weston becomes fully possessed by the spirit of Satan. He becomes the unman.
Yes.
The anti-human being. And the level of evil is bottomless. It's creepy. It's fighting an animated corpse.
Yep. Well, one of the things that struck me finally in my rereadings of Perelandra is how emblematic Ransom's climb is. Because spiritual theology requires this strife, this purpose to the strife of life. You've climbed through this cave because when you get to the top, there's the pinnacle of glory that you will experience. And that's what Ransom finally does.
So he climbs up
in darkness,
a mountain from the inside.
Yeah.
There's nothing like it. I'll never forget the first time I read it. Yeah. I thought, this is just genius. There's nothing. Yeah. I've never read anything like this.
And then towards the end, of course, he's fed on the planet. It's as though the fat planet itself is feeding him. And then he meets the queen and the king. And he sees the two tutelary spirits. One is Malacandra, the tutelary spirit of Mars. And the other is Perelandra herself, the Eldila of that
planet. So these are these angelic, I don't know if they're thrones, principalities, I don't know what they are, but they're very, very high-level angelic beings.
Yeah.
And Lewis calls them Oyarsa?
Yep. She is the Oyarsa of Perelandra.
Okay. And I love the fact that you take issue in your book. In other words, it's Lewis is such an unparalleled genius that it's nice when you can find a mistake, when you can find something that he does that you just say, nah, that's, I don't like
uh-oh,
that.
Uh-oh, what did I say?
Well, no, you're right, because it struck me every time I've read the book. He refers to the Mal Eldil. Yeah. Say about what that is.
Well, it's a common root meaning evil.
Mal, of course.
Yeah.
But who's the Mal Eldil?
Oh, Mal Eldil is the creator of the second person of the Trinity.
Is God. So the fact that Lewis, who is himself a philologist, a studier of language, student of language, that he uses the term just to describe God at Mal Eldil. And you think, well, wait a minute, Mal, M-A-L, we know that that's supposed to be bad. So why is there any explanation for where he came up with this, just to be annoying?
Lewis liked the sounds of certain words and combinations of letters. You know how this book originated?
No.
It originated in a dream. He had dreams of floating islands.
Okay. I guess now that you mentioned it, I've read that someplace, but I forgot.
Yeah, well, where did that come from? That's what I would ask, you know.
Well, because he's a mystic.
Of course.
No different than seeing the image of a faun carrying packages in a wood.
Which gives us seven books. You know, and let us recall the pinnacle of Ransom's vision at the end. He sees the king, and he looks upon the face of the king. He realizes that he's looking upon the face of Jesus.
Coming up,
I regard this, Eric, as Lewis's greatest apologetic achievement, just the pinnacle of his work, of his intent, of his vocation, this book.
More on Mystical Perelandra when the Christian Outlook continues in a moment. Stay with us.
As the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy enters our 25th anniversary year, we've remained committed to a single truth of world history, that ideas have consequences, To understand these ideas and their impact on today's politics, and to test them quantitatively, requires the unique curriculum we offer on our Malibu, California campus. Apply now for fall classes at pepperdine.edu/SPP. That's pepperdine.edu/SPP.
Welcome back to the Christian Outlook. I'm Don Crow. One gift of C.S. Lewis is his ability to bring the reader to epiphany sort of experiences. In this case, through fiction, the ability to see spiritual realities, facets of Christ's work on our behalf, and the glories of the Christian's eternal hope. Let's continue. Eric Metaxas with James Como, author of Mystical Perilandra.
So you were just talking about this moment when the hero, he goes underneath the sea and comes out inside the mountain on this planet and fights his way up. I mean, it's just incredible. And eventually comes out the top of this mountain and looks on the face of
Jesus.
Well,
the king. He sees the king
of Perilandra.
Of that world.
And so how is that the face of Jesus? In other words, it's somehow similar to the face of Jesus.
Well, I think Ransom recognizes it because I think somehow the Eldila, Venus and Mars, Perilandra and Malacandra, communicate to him that this is, now that the planet is unfallen and will not fall, is what our Lord has intended all along, right? And Lewis, of course, had read St. Bonaventure, who was a mystic himself, and wrote about mysticism, the three parts of mysticism and so on. And he has a long passage on the face of Jesus as the most glorious thing you could behold. And Ransom experiences that when he's there. And then it spins off into what you know as the great dance, which is a favorite image of Lewis. And the king takes him through eons and eons and eons, and he says, when we get to the end of these eons, it not even then is the beginning. We're not yet at the beginning. Yeah. So Lewis's mastery of perspective is at its pinnacle here. I regard this, Eric, as Lewis's greatest apologetic achievement, just the pinnacle of his work, of his intent, of his vocation, this book.
And he was only 45 years old when he wrote this.
Yeah.
The thing that strikes me is the chutzpah to write about what he writes about in Perilandra. Like, you know, to talk about seeing the face of Jesus, who goes there, so to speak? Most people just are not, you know, unless you have seen it yourself and have the ability to write about it, which you get the impression somehow he did.
I want to point this out, though. People talk about the achievement of C.S. Lewis, how many books he wrote, how they're still in print, the number of movies made about Lewis and his life, documentaries made about C.S. Lewis, translations of C.S. Lewis. All of this is true. Sales, you know, the multi-millions. The real power of C.S. Lewis is in the heart, imagination, soul, and mind of every single individual reader as he reads Lewis. That is the power of Lewis. One of the reasons I wrote this book, I mentioned in the preface, I've named a new subgenre of literary criticism. I'm calling it recovery criticism. People who were enchanted by Lewis, usually the chronicles, but now that they're grown-ups, they've gotten over it. You see, they've seen through Lewis, so they write their books, good books, well-written books, about how they were wrong, but now they've seen this and that, and so they're beyond this, which usually means they've given up their Christian worldview. Well, I wanted to rebut the recovery genre by saying, here's a guy who was a young, very young man, got to Lewis, and not only have I not recovered from him, but it's deepened and deepened more and more. And that is the power of C.S. Lewis.
Well, listen, let's be clear. If you think of the Narnia Chronicles as children's books, Lewis made it clear that they're not. He wrote about writing and about fairy tales and about story. And one of the first things that I picked up from Lewis is that these genres, whether fairy tales or quote-unquote children's books, they're for everyone. It's just a different kind of genre, which may work for kids. But, I mean, look, I read the Narnia Chronicles for the first time when I was 30.
Really?
Yeah.
Really?
And I, as a writer, with literary aspirations, I said, this is some of the most fine writing I've ever encountered. It's just astonishingly brilliant. And that's, to me, the strength of Lewis, is that he's able to write about things that we would think of as innocent, but they are not. It's not saccharine innocence. It's innocence with depth, which is the goodness of God. It's an innocence. It's Aslan's not the tame lion. He is good and frightening because he is Aslan. It's a level of goodness. And so that's kind of what makes Lewis so rare, is there very few writers who are able to pull all this kind of stuff off. And he does, I mean, in so many different genres.
I don't think there's any other writer who pulls it off as well.
That's a fact. I mean, that is a flat-out fact. Because of what Lewis has written, innumerable lives have been changed and improved. Innumerable. And so you talk about somebody's legacy. Lewis, there's a moral character. You can't get away from it. There's genius, but there are plenty of geniuses. I mean, I don't think many lives have been improved by reading Ulysses or Finnegan's Wake. I'm sorry. I just don't. Or a lot of these people that you recognize there's genius, but Lewis didn't just have genius. He had genius and moral courage, and he infused them with each other, and you get something different. It has a moral quality. So when you said who was it, Henry James?
Shakespeare. That nothing was lost on him.
Well, actually, no. Then I'm thinking of Lewis. What Lewis said about Edmund Spencer is that to read him is to grow in mental health. That's true of Lewis. Is to read Lewis is to grow in mental and spiritual health. How many literary geniuses can we say that about? Not very few.
Very few. Very few. I mean, there might be a couple of dozen, but given how many have written, that's very few, isn't it?
Well, I mean, I guess I think about Lewis helps you learn how to live.
Well, Lewis first taught me how to think. That my first impression of Lewis was intellectual, and the impact was intellectual. And I thought, this guy, you know, I was a debater. I was an argumentative kid. You know, I could take on anybody. And this is one guy I would never want to have to debate, because he just knew too much and was too incisive in his thinking. Then came the imagination, because I love fairy tales myself, have written some fairy tales, and then came the spirit. Right? And they're all linked. That's the thing about Lewis. The intellect is not separate from your spirit. You know, it's another avenue into your spiritual growth.
Coming up,
the achievement of C.S. Lewis in my soul, in my mind, was the achievement of hope.
Our last segment on Mystical Perilandra, when the Christian Outlook returns in a moment.
Hi, it's Mike Gallagher. I start every day by reading through the stories at Daybreak Insider. In just 10 minutes, I can zip through 10 stories that help me start my day and help shape where I go with the Mike Gallagher Show. Over 250,000 people get Daybreak Insider by email daily, and it's available to you at no cost. Go to daybreakinsider.com and simply plug in your email. That's daybreakinsider.com. In 5 minutes, you will be the most informed person in the office. That's daybreakinsider.com.
Welcome back to the Christian Outlook. I'm Don Crow. I hope you've enjoyed the time in conversation centered around C.S. Lewis's book, Perilandra. This conversation, though, is really just one more reminder of the gift that C.S. Lewis has been to multiple generations of readers. Here again, James Como with Eric Metaxas.
I was just thinking of Lewis's poem, What the Bird Said Early in the Year. I could cry. It's so beautiful. I think I remember it begins, I heard in Addison's walk a bird sing clear. This year, the summer will come true. This year, this year. It's just so glorious. And you think, if I had just written that poem, I could retire. and it's virtually unknown in his oeuvre. It's just this poem. But it's so beautiful because it links the world of fairy tale with the kingdom of God. It's just, that's what Lewis does. He brings these things together.
Yeah. In here, he brings it together. You're the meeting point. You're the intersection of that, because he's your surrogate.
was it Hooper? I think you quote him that said that Lewis was the most thoroughly converted man he'd ever known.
Yeah.
What did he mean by that?
Well, I once asked Walter because he told me that too, and I once asked him. He says there was nothing about Lewis that wasn't converted, not his intellect, not his imagination, not his appetites, you know, carnally, corporally, intellectually. All of it was converted. And the only thing that mattered to Lewis, and Owen Barfield, his great friend, says this about Lewis, the only reason Lewis paid attention to himself was as a kind of examiner looking to correct the flaws that would get him into heaven, right?
Wow.
And he was worried about his own fame. You know, I think I point this out in the book.
Yeah, you do.
He has this wonderful poem called The Apologist's Evening Prayer, which ends with, "Lord of the narrow gate and needle's eye, take from me all my trumpery," meaning his work, "lest I die." You know, and at one point he writes the Italian priest, right, that he's afraid he won't write anything else. The well has dried up. And that's a good thing, because he was starting to believe all of the rave reviews he was getting, and it was a temptation to pride. So if the price of avoiding pride was never to write again, so be it. Of course, out pours Narnia shortly thereafter, so.
Yeah.
So much for that.
And you could, in some ways, you could argue that's his greatest work. I mean, those seven books are unlike anything that exists. They are just beyond belief.
Almost every genre Lewis touched, he wrote the landmark. The achievement of C.S. Lewis in my soul, in my mind, was the achievement of hope. You read Lewis, and I've never had a crisis of faith, but hope has dimmed from time to time. And I get back to Lewis, and I realize, because of him, what's waiting for us. And hope is rekindled, because he saw it.
That concludes our program today. I hope you enjoyed it. If you did, go to ChristianOutlook.com and take a moment to subscribe to our podcast on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, and Google Play, and never miss these and other great conversations. Thanks for joining us. Our program has been brought to you in part through our partnership with the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy. I'm Don Crow. Join us again next time for The Christian Outlook.
Three-star general Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
With in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never-before-seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.